tiny, tiny particles from outer space are a huge find for scientists.
And we still have to pinch ourselves. It's never happened before.
I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
It's not too cumbersome. The suit's pretty flexible. It just gets a little hot inside.
You ferment it, dry it, and then roast it.
You have to be on point every single day.
They want that medication, they use the coupon, but then the coupon goes away.
I want to eat more of this.
That's such
and I don't
want to
move at all. I just want to sit around. And that's the problem.
Putting the word chemical on something that can make it scary out of it.
On today's show, what the election outcomes mean for health and science, how the fear of Ebola is impacting immigrant communities, and why forests might be key in reducing the effects of climate change. But first up, this weekend, actor Matthew McConaughey will head into outer space on a quest to save mankind.
Everybody ready to say goodbye to our solar system?
To our galaxy.
Here we go.
The new mega sci-fi movie directed by Christopher Nolan is called Interstellar. The protagonist, a farmer/astronaut tasked with finding a hospitable planet since Earth no longer fits that category. Well, we think we've got a better story from the far reaches of the solar system. Todd Bookman reports on NASA's mission to bring home a few fast-moving particles of space dust.
I don't know if I can hang with Matthew McConaughey, but how's this for an opening scene?
3, 2, we have main engine start, 0, and liftoff of the Stardust spacecraft returning a time capsule with the elements of the formation of our solar system.
February 7th, 1999, the unmanned Stardust spacecraft sets off from Cape Canaveral. A year later, it arrives at its destination, out beyond the orbit of Mars. And that's where it goes to work, aiming to capture and preserve specks of dust born outside of our solar system. So, first step, a robotic arm with a collector unit on its end, picture a big tennis racket, gets extended outside of the craft, dangling into what's called the interstellar dust stream.
It just captured particles, just as you would if you were holding up a piece of flypaper and catching flies by waving it through the air.
It's not quite as simple as astronomer Andrew Westfall would have you believe. For starters, the dust particles are moving at speeds approaching 12 miles per second. Something moving that fast hits something else, and there's a good chance it vaporizes on impact. So NASA developed a high-tech substance, a bluish-colored gel, to coat the collector's surface. It acts like a foam landing pad, slowing the particles down. After 200 days of exposure to the dust stream, the collector was reeled in, boxed up, and placed in a return capsule. Next stop, Utah.
I was there with my family, actually, about 2 o'clock in the morning. We watched it come in the middle of a blizzard, and it was kind of an amazing experience to see this.
NASA has footage from that night in 2006. You see a faint glow, then slowly this streak brightens across the sky before crashing down in the desert.
Above Mars.
Oh, that's cool. Quite a trail.
NearSpec has a great view.
Oh, we got that, boys!
Now that the collector was back safe on land, Westfall's research team at UC Berkeley had to try to pluck these little space dust particles out of the gel. Emphasis here on the little.
Yeah, so these are really tiny. To put this into some perspective, they're so small that about a trillion of them would fit into a teaspoon.
That impossibly small size presented something of a problem.
We were faced with this really difficult challenge. We have this, what is for us, a very, very large object, which has, we thought, a few dozen at most, tiny little particles in it. And the difficulty, the challenge was, how do we find these things in the first place?
Westfall and his team at Berkeley had an idea. If they could use a microscope to zoom in and move through the gel and take pictures of it, more than a million pictures from different angles, then they could upload those photos to a public website. The operation became known as Stardust at Home, and eventually 30,000 volunteers logged on and scanned through the images.
So, you know, I want to emphasize that this was not something we made up for public outreach or PR. We did this because this is really the only way we knew how to approach the problem.
This group, some of whom spent hours and hours each day clicking through slides, came to be called dusters, and two dusters hit pay dirt, discovering actual space dust in the gel. Five other particles were spotted in the lab, and so scientists think they've got their hands on seven particles from outside the solar system. Each one appears different under the microscope, with some containing the mineral olivine as well as sulfur compounds. It will take years to confirm their origins, but if proven, harnessing these specks could be a major breakthrough for astronomers interested in the interstellar medium.
The name of the book I've written is Physics of the Interstellar and Intergalactic Medium. It took me a lot longer to write it than I thought it was going to when I started, but I'm happy that I finished it.
Bruce Drain is an astrophysicist at Princeton. His textbook is standard reading for grad students studying space and is beyond comprehension for the rest of us. He's not involved in the Stardust Project, but says the particles could confirm what, until now, has just been theory about their makeup and origin.
One goal of studying them might be purely to understand them for their own sake, to figure out how they came, what they are, and how they came to be that way. But these dust particles turn out to be very important players in the workings of a galaxy.
Figuring out this dust, Drain says, is like solving one clue in the crossword puzzle of the universe. If we get this, we get a little closer to answering other harder questions. Big picture stuff, like how our solar system was formed. Andrew Westfall sees it like this.
I kind of like to make the analogy to the paleoanthropologists who go out to Africa and they look for fossil hominids, you know, our ancestors who lived 4.5 million years ago, for example. We're going back about 1,000 times further in time to 4.5 billion years ago and looking at the kind of stuff that made up our solar system. So it's really about a search for our own origins.
And that search continues. There's still more photos for the dusters to look through, and perhaps a few more space particles waiting to be discovered. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. From space dust to the fallout from Tuesday's election, the results meant big wins for the Republicans. They took control of the Senate and won some of the closest governor's races. Carolyn Beeler is joining us now in the studio to talk about the implications of the midterms on health and environmental policies. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Maiken.
Now, first off, Tom Wolf, as expected, defeated incumbent Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett on Tuesday. Corbett spent much of the past year developing something called Healthy PA, which is an expanded insurance program for the poor, an alternative to a Medicaid expansion. What's going to happen to that program now under Wolf?
Well, Wolf, during his campaign, said he'd scrap Corbett's plan and go for a straight Medicaid expansion. So it looks like Corbett's program, as it is now, is likely going to disappear. That program, Healthy PA, got around technically expanding Medicaid by using federal subsidies to pay for private insurance plans for poor Pennsylvanians, people just above the poverty line. The potential problem here is timing. Wolf doesn't take office until mid-January, and coverage starts at the beginning of January for the expected half a million new enrollees. So any changes to the program are going to have to happen while people are actually already on the insurance.
So what does that mean? They just don't have insurance then?
No. What I'm hearing is that it's likely that as long as people don't have a gap in coverage, the federal government will be likely to work with the state to transform Healthy PA into Medicaid or something that looks a lot like it, if indeed that's what Wolf does.
And what's the difference, if you can sum it up, between a Medicaid expansion and Healthy PA?
There are some differences in coverage, but a big thing is that Healthy PA was going to start charging enrollees premiums in 2016, so that would be scrapped under traditional Medicaid. Cost-wise, Corbett said Healthy PA will save the state money. Wolf says that Medicaid expansion is going to add $3 billion to the state's GDP, so right now it's sort of he said.
All right, we'll see. We have to talk about fracking quickly before we move on to the national results. That was a big topic during this election.
Right, and after the election, a lot of environmentalists are pretty happy. Some of the gas companies, not so happy. Wolf campaigned on a 5% tax on natural gas production in Pennsylvania instead of Corbett's current local impact fee. But he'll have to get that passed a Republican legislature, and the natural gas drillers are certain to put up a fight, so it's sort of not clear at this point if he'll be able to deliver on that campaign promise. Wolf also supports moratoriums on new oil and gas leasing in state parks and forests and a moratorium on hydraulic fracturing in the Delaware River Basin.
Let's look at some of the national results. A lot of Republicans campaigned on repealing or defunding the Affordable Care Act. What's going to happen now?
So it's likely that there's going to be a symbolic vote, a symbolic bill to repeal or defund the Affordable Care Act. Even Mitch McConnell at this point, though, says, you know, that's not actually going to happen. So pretty quickly, they're likely to move to the nitty-gritties of trying to whittle away at certain provisions of the law. In his victory speech Wednesday, presumed Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell outlined some specific provisions he's likely to start going after.
I will say this for sure. There are pieces of it that are deeply, deeply unpopular with the American people. The medical device tax, which has exported an enormous number of jobs. The loss of the 40-hour work week, big, big mistake. That ought to be restored. The individual mandate, people hate it.
That loss of the 40-hour work week comments referring to the rule that requires full-time workers to be covered by their employers, but defines full-time as 30 hours a week instead of 40.
But what are the actual chances of any of this actually getting repealed?
Well, I'd say the medical device tax is low-hanging fruit. The president, after the election, didn't say a flat-out no when that repeal was brought up. Many think it's also possible there might be some changes to the employer mandate. But the individual mandate, that requirement that everyone has insurance, is sort of what makes the whole Affordable Care Act work economically, and that's really not likely to go anywhere.
Let's talk about the environment. What does the new makeup of the Senate mean for environmental policies?
Well, one thing we're likely to see sooner rather than later is a law coming from the Republican Senate pushing for the Keystone XL pipeline. That's not likely to get past a presidential veto. Beyond that, it's likely the Senate is going to try to start chipping away at President Obama's Clean Power Plan rule. That's the rule that requires states to reduce their carbon emissions coming from power plants. The Senate might try to repeal that rule or try to defund the Environmental Protection Agency through the appropriations process. But I talked to the Brookings Institution's Bill and Tholis, and he says both of those things would require presidential approval, which they wouldn't get.
And so instead, what's likely to happen is the EPA will continue to get funded based on continuing resolutions and the like, and there will be a bit of a standstill.
Ultimately, legislators will likely try to slow down environmental proceedings with lots of questioning and hearings and document requests.
It will definitely continue to add to the stalemate in Washington, or at least to the hostility between the administration and Congress.
So everybody's talking about working together and getting stuff done,
right,
but sounds like a little bit of more of the same coming our way.
Yeah, at least on some of these controversial issues. I think there will be significant gridlock in Washington still.
And Carolyn, of course, there's a lot more to be considered and thought about, and we've posted a lot of that information on our website.
Right. A lot of links on whyy.org/thepulse.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Thanks, Maiken.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. It's been dubbed Fearbola, the fear of the virus that seems to be spreading faster than Ebola itself. West African immigrants in the region are reporting cases of discrimination fueled by this fear, and some are taking legal action. The African Cultural Alliance of North America on Chester Ave in Philadelphia serves as a hub of connection for the city's large West African immigrant community.
What I'm explaining to you is if you choose to send in the work permit, that's your choice.
Staff attorney Chioma Azi has been busy answering calls and questions about Ebola discrimination. For example, this from a woman about to go on a trip to Europe.
She's of Sierra Leonean descent, but she is a U.S. citizen. She asked me, I'm traveling to England. Will I be quarantined if I come back? And I told her, no, absolutely not.
Azi has also experienced discrimination closer to home.
My own grandmother, who's from Uganda in East Africa, was denied treatment by her own personal doctor.
The appointment was scheduled about a month after her grandmother had returned from a trip to her home country.
But then when they learned that she had just arrived, they canceled it and they cited Ebola and said that they just don't want to run the risk.
Uganda is about 2,000 miles away from the countries where Ebola is active.
You know, you could hear the fear in her voice and the panic, just not wanting anything to do. And actually, she flatly told us that they're not treating anyone from Africa.
Azi has filed a complaint about the incident with the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission.
Okay.
Let's come back. This is my life. So.
Okay.
Wafi Jabate heads the African Cultural Alliance of North America, and he wants to reassure people that West Africans are doing what they can to halt the spread of the disease.
The message should be clear. We are Americans, and we ourselves don't want Ebola to impact our own family or the general population.
Philadelphia's health department directs calls about Ebola discrimination to the city's Commission on Human Relations, where Rue Landau is director.
Hysteria has never been an effective tool when dealing with health concerns. It is very important that people get the facts about the disease itself and also get the facts about discrimination.
Landau said the city commission will investigate all Ebola discrimination claims. Coming up on The Pulse, it's deja vu for enrolling in Obamacare.
Once I gave up, you know, because I lived so many years without health care, I thought, well, okay, so much for that. I didn't know there would be another open enrollment, which to me feels like a nightmare coming on again. Like, okay, I'll try again.
Still to come, you're listening to The Pulse here on WHYY.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Doesn't it seem like we just got through the ACA enrollment period? Well, guess what? A year has gone by and it's time for round two. Open enrollment for Obamacare begins again on November 15th. Are you ready? Last year's launch of the online marketplaces was a bit of a disaster. Elana Gordon has this preview of what's in store.
Andrea Pearl Pinkett works at a fabric store in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. That's not all she does.
I'm a vocalist. I'm a jazz vocalist.
You wouldn't know it from her smiles and humor, but she's in a lot of pain. Her fingers sometimes lock up. Her wrists pop. So she wraps them in fabric. And she sings.
It's not the pale moon that excites me. Oh, thrills and delights me.
She turns to this jazz standard. The nearness of you, a lot.
It's just the nearness of you.
Pinkett, who's 63, is a people person. But she's isolated herself because of her health problems.
I don't want to distance myself from people. I'm totally the opposite. But I'm always in pain.
It's just the nearness of you.
So she got excited when she heard about Obamacare last year and the possibility of having access to insurance and a doctor. That is, until logging onto the website during those awful first few weeks.
It crashed. I crashed. It kicked me off. I got depressed. And I gave up. So no, I have no health insurance. I have many health issues.
Pinkett will soon have another chance to sign up when the second enrollment period begins November 15th. It runs for 3 months. Problem is, she's still overwhelmed.
Well, Andrea's in good company.
Karen Politz is a health policy expert at the Kaiser Family Foundation, and she's been closely following the rollout of these new healthcare marketplaces during year one.
It's an intimidating process, to be sure.
Politz says, hang in there, Andrea. New programs always have a learning curve. Since last year, the marketplaces brought in new IT contractors, and they've corrected a lot of those technical problems for consumers. The online application in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and other states will be easier, with just 16 screens to go through instead of nearly 80. Experts do worry about the technology behind the scenes between insurers and the marketplaces. But Politz says despite all the initial problems, one of the biggest takeaways from year one is that a lot of people out there want insurance. 8 million people signed up for private plans.
You know, we saw a significant drop in the number of uninsured. I haven't seen that in my whole career.
More than 100,000 people around Philadelphia signed up. The quality of coverage and the options patients have in accessing doctors still remains to be seen. But for Charlene Wong, a pediatrician and researcher at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, the bigger underlying challenge in the enrollment process is understanding how insurance works.
It's so hard to explain. It's a difficult concept.
Wong closely tracked a group of young adults as they tried signing up for coverage this past year. She found that even savvy, college-educated people got stumped by the basics.
Like what a deductible is, what a coinsurance is, copayment, out-of-pocket maximum. You know, these words appear all over healthcare.gov on the website.
A deductible, for example, is typically the amount of money that people pay for any healthcare services before insurance kicks in and begins to pay. Coinsurance is the percentage of what an insurance plan pays for certain services once a person meets that deductible. Out-of-pocket maximum is the most a person would have to pay in an insurance year for all covered services. Wong worries that the marketplace designers have yet to clearly lay this out for people, even though she thinks pop-up boxes and the use of narratives would really help.
Because if they don't understand that their $6,000 deductible means that they're going to be paying out of their own pocket up to $6,000 before their health insurance kicks in, that can be a really rude awakening when you go to seek care for the first time and realize that your insurance actually isn't paying for anything yet.
Wong's colleague, Tom Baker, over at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, says beyond understanding insurance, it's really, really hard to compare plans on the new marketplaces. And people have a lot to choose from, more than 24 plans in Philadelphia last year.
I mean, the biggest thing I wish they would do is I wish they really had more decision support.
Baker says his research is starting to hint that a lot of people are not choosing their best option with the current comparison tools. He thinks with time that will get better, but not by next week. So his big lesson from year one for Andrea Pinkett and others, be patient. And this is key. Get help. There are free certified insurance assisters out there.
If I was advising Andrea right now, I would say as soon as open enrollment begins, talk to an enrollment assistant, talk to a person, and then make a judgment. There aren't perfect decision support tools, but I think you're going to make a better choice than if you wait for the last minute and do it on the website.
This time around, Andrea Pinkett says she'll be doing just that. She's more determined to get enrolled now, having seen a good friend benefit from having coverage and gain access to needed medications and specialists.
I mean, to feel like somebody's going to care that you can't move your thumbs or simply can't get out of the bed, and that I'm going to be able to get help for that, to keep that from happening, I could cry right now.
For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Are you already enrolled in Obamacare? You are not off the hook. Go to our website at whyy.org/thepulse for what you have to do and also for more information on the ACA's implications for everyone, especially this coming tax season. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and you're going to feel just a little pinch.
You're trying not to flex your muscle once again. Yeah.
A 12-year-old girl is getting her HPV shot.
Oh!
health officials say not enough children are getting this shot to protect them from the human papillomavirus. To push those numbers up, the government has invested lots of dollars in vaccine education campaigns and public service announcements like this one.
Oral and throat cancers are on the rise, and HPV infection is the reason. HPV is the same virus that causes cervical cancer. That's why vaccination is recommended for both boys and girls.
A new study from the University of Pennsylvania questions if improving knowledge among parents and kids works to improve vaccination rates, or maybe it's doctors that need a bit more education and training. Tanya English reports.
HPV infection is spread during sex and most often picked up by young people in their teens and 20s. It's the virus that causes genital warts and can lead later in life to cervical cancer in women and throat cancers in men. The vaccine is a cancer prevention tool, and that's why so many public health people think it's important. Behavior scientist Jessica Fishman studies why people make healthy choices. She says in public health, the thinking goes like this. If people have the right information, they'll take the right steps.
There's been a lot of emphasis on if only they knew, if only they knew, then, right?
The University of Pennsylvania team surveyed low-income girls and their parents in Philadelphia to find out what those families know about the virus and the vaccine. The researchers wondered, does having better HPV information mean you're more likely to get the shots?
It didn't really make a difference if you had the knowledge or not.
That finding, Fishman says, is a break from what people in public health have believed for a very long time. Colleagues warned her, don't waste your time.
There's sometimes a surprising amount of politics and science. So there are people who have argued for a long time that knowledge must be the key. We find something that doesn't support that argument, and it can be troubling or upsetting or surprising to some people.
Fishman is not troubled. Instead of focusing on what kids and parents know and do, she says maybe there's an opportunity to change the behavior of doctors or the health system.
Make sure that the vaccination is in stock. Make sure that they know who is due for vaccinations. Send out reminders.
The Centers for Disease Control says girls and boys should get the HPV vaccine around age 11 or 12 to make sure they're protected years before they start having sex. Fishman says doctors are pretty direct when they talk to parents about the vaccines against tetanus or meningitis. The vaccine rate for those shots hovers around 80 or 85%. Fishman says the doctor-patient chat can get wishy-washy, though, when it comes to HPV. Only about 60% of girls nationwide have had their first dose of the vaccine, and coverage is even lower for boys.
A lot of physicians sometimes recommend the other two, and then when it comes to HPV, they're like, well, let's start a conversation about this. This is something we can talk about and explore, and you don't have to get it now. And it's not clear to the patient or the parent that this is a recommended vaccine just like the other ones.
Physicians need to tell people the shots that they need and let them decide if they want it or don't want that, as opposed to sort of like it's a menu at a restaurant. Oh, would you like this or would you like this? I say these are the things they're getting, and then the parent can say, I don't want it.
Hal Bike leads Nemours DuPont Pediatrics in Wilmington. He says doctors at the Jessup Street Health Center present the HPV vaccine with the same emphasis and importance as the other recommended shots.
Her exam looked normal today. The only concern Pearl had is what vaccinations does she need. So okay. That's what we need to talk about.
There are three shots in the HPV series, and Pearl Miller got her first dose a year ago. Listen as pediatrician Gina Amoroso speaks with the 12-year-old and her mom.
So I'd like to do the second today. Mm-hmm. There's actually been some recent research that has indicated that the sooner you get the three in, the better protection you have lifelong. So okay. I think we're at an opportune place right now to give her her second.
Pearl's okay with that plan until Dr. Amoroso fesses up that the HPV vaccine pinches a little bit more than some other shots.
When he starts sticking to me, like, every time I had to go to the doctor, to start hurting. I don't like shots.
You'll be fine.
It all sounds pretty routine. Amoroso says it's actually the first conversation about HPV that can be tricky. That's when parents push back and have a few reservations.
The most common is, my child's not sexually active, so it's not something I need to do right now.
Pearl's mom, Carla Miller, did ask a few questions, but she says she believed Dr. Amoroso when she said the vaccine could protect Pearl later in life.
Basically, I had some concerns about it, and
They basically broke it down and told me, you know, it really wasn't no worries about it.
My hope is that they have a trust in me from the day they bring me their child. So when they do turn 11, they're looking to me to provide them with the right direction and guidance. It is extremely powerful to be able to prevent a cancer.
In Philadelphia, HPV vaccination rates are lower than health officials hope, but are still some of the best in the nation. The city's improvement plan includes vaccination reminder messages sent directly to the parents of teenagers and providing conversation tips to help doctors talk to moms and dads. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
You're listening to The Pulse. This week's report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warns that without substantial and sustained reductions in greenhouse gases, risks to people and ecosystems would be severe. Among other things, the report advises policymakers to encourage the growth of forests and trees that absorb carbon. In Pennsylvania and across the eastern seaboard, forests are changing. Some people fret about what's happening and blame global warming. Others say the role of climate change in the makeup of eastern forests is exaggerated. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips takes us into the woods with a landowner who is on a mission to heal her forest.
This is my grandfather with his team of horses, his son-in-law, my dayan.
In a 19th century farmhouse deep in northern Pennsylvania's Bradford County, Nancy Baker shows photos dating back four generations. Her home was built by her great-grandfather, a Scots-Irish immigrant who cut timber from the virgin forest and shipped it down the Susquehanna River. The story of how the Baker family used its land was replayed up and down the East Coast after European settlers arrived. They cut down woods for timber. Then they turned to farming, yanking rocks from the stony soil to mark out cow pastures. In the 20th century, their children left the land for better jobs in town. And with the land left to itself, the forests returned.
When we inherited this land from my mother, I sort of said, okay, now it's ours. Now it's our turn to steward the land. How are we going to do this?
It's a question a lot of foresters are debating in the age of climate change. But they don't all agree on what to do. Walking through these woods today, Baker says the changes to her forest have become abrupt.
The death of a tree is pretty normal to me. But it's like in human beings, we say someone lived a good life if they lived a long life. And we say that they were cut short. Some of these things are being cut short.
So Baker, who has a degree in forestry, is taking steps to heal what she sees as a sickness in her woods, one fueled by climate change. Warming is not always bad for trees. Some species will thrive in new areas. Others could die out. So in the calculus of global warming, forests can play the dual role of victim and solution. Just this week, a major report by the UN emphasized the vital role forests play in absorbing carbon and limiting greenhouse gases. But what looks to a city dweller like a lush green canopy looks very different to someone who has spent a lifetime in these woods.
It is warmer than they are used to. I see trees dropping out of the ecosystem. I see new species coming in that are not native. So the whole system changes.
The state's climate change assessment says Pennsylvania's forests are still in good shape. But the study warns that trees such as the American beech, sugar maple, and black cherry won't adapt well to a warmer climate in Pennsylvania. To Baker, who grew up playing in these woods, not trying to save these trees is unthinkable. For her, this goes beyond the forest's value as an antidote to global warming, beyond the vital cooling shade that hemlocks provide for the brook trout in Panther Lick Creek. To her, the stakes are a matter of the spirit.
We look to the forest as comfort and solace, and it actually hurts us when something goes wrong with it. You know, just as if you would care for a person and something happened to that person, it sort of damages your soul to some degree. So damage to the forest damages our psyche.
Baker is now working with a forester on a plan to improve the health of her woods. She pulls out invasive species and tries to treat her sick trees. She's also planting new species that are better suited to survive a warmer climate. Scientists call this assisted migration. Trees can't just pick up and move, so it takes a long time for them to migrate. Some advocate helping nature along by planting more typically southern species up north.
Are we good?
The 70-year-old baker drives around her 163 acres in a revved-up off-road vehicle, aptly named a mule.
Now, can you see there's a wire cage out there? There's an orange flag on
it. She's pointing to a tulip poplar sapling. Each carefully placed seedling has been caged to protect it from hungry deer. Her plan is controversial. First, not everyone agrees that climate change is the real problem here. A recent report by a Penn State researcher says the stresses on eastern forests have more to do with 500 years of land use trauma inflicted by European settlers. And not everyone agrees with planting new species in preparation for warmer, wetter winters and hotter summers. They fear unintended consequences. About 300 miles northeast of Baker's land lies the Harvard Forest in Petersham, Massachusetts. That forest is going through similar changes, so I called up Aaron Ellison, a senior research fellow there, and asked him about Baker's plan to prepare her forest for climate change. Ellison didn't like it. He opposes assisted migration.
We want to feel like we're doing something. We want to get out. We want to pull those invasive species. We want to move bison around. We want to reintroduce wolves. Sometimes it's okay to not do things, and not doing something is actually doing something.
Ellison says planting new trees and nursing them toward a new forest is too expensive and time-consuming to be practical. And history is full of cautionary tales about moving species around. Instead of planting different trees, Ellison suggested hiring a hunter to kill the deer that eat young saplings.
So what she needs to do is put a fence up, put the hunter inside the fence to wipe out every last deer and leave the fence up. And then the regeneration will proceed so fast and she'll be delighted.
Ellison himself is dealing with a pest that's killing all the hemlock trees on his 100 acres in western Massachusetts. But Ellison plans on just letting all his trees die and seeing what comes next. Back in the forest in Pennsylvania, Nancy Baker is definitely not okay with just waiting to see what happens next. In addition to changes she links to global warming, globalization is also taking its toll with new pests.
I'm just going to have to duck through this.
Wow, this is all dead.
Yes. It's just a disaster.
Baker's ash trees have fallen prey to an Asian beetle called the emerald ash borer.
And if you just did nothing, what do you think would happen?
Oh, I think it'd be in a horrendous heap eventually. It'd be dead and be replaced by I don't know what. But I wouldn't be looking forward to that.
So while Ellison, the Harvard scientist, takes a hands-off approach, Nancy Baker says the forests won't just rebound by themselves. They need active intervention. But here's one thing they can agree on. Her effort to save her woods is an experiment with no assurance it will work. But as Baker says, climate change is also an experiment without a control.
And that goes contrary to all the scientific method that we've ever used. So who knows what's going to happen?
For The Pulse, I'm Susan Phillips.
Coming up on The Pulse, an artist deals with addiction and obsessive-compulsive disorder.
And I was obsessed. I compared myself to every dancer. I would measure the width of my thighs every day. I would ask my sister to point the arch of her foot and compare mine to hers.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY. But she don't love. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Next Tuesday is Veterans Day, and our next story takes us to an Army hospital that treated thousands of wounded soldiers during the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in southwestern Germany is the largest military hospital outside of the U.S., and it's closest to the battle zones. So wounded soldiers are usually brought there first and then back to the U.S. Joining us now are two healthcare professionals who've spent quite a bit of time at Landstuhl Hospital, Carol and Michael Weingarten. Carol is an associate professor of nursing at Villanova University. Michael is chief of vascular surgery at Drexel University College of Medicine, and they've taken several trips to Germany to volunteer at that hospital. Carol and Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael, what was it like when you got over there for the first time? What were your expectations and what did you find?
When we first started, we saw casualties from Iraq. Coalition troops were injured and brought over to Germany. Over the last few years, it's been mostly from Afghanistan. The types of injuries that we saw over there are nothing. You don't see anything like this in the United States. I covered trauma at our Level 1 Trauma Center. We don't see those types of injuries. I saw really incredible medical care. These soldiers are getting astounding care at every step of the way. And these soldiers in previous wars probably would not have survived, but now they are surviving.
So describe the kind of patients you work with here and then contrast that to the people you worked with at Landstuhl.
Sure. In an inner-city trauma center, we see a lot of penetrating injuries such as gunshots and stab wounds and motor vehicle accidents. The typical injury over there is improvised explosive devices, which have devastating effects on these soldiers. And so just resuscitating them and getting them through that is a very different proposition.
And I would think also the patients arriving at this military hospital have been in transport for a lot longer than your typical patient.
Well, it's interesting. After injury, they get initial care in Iraq or Afghanistan, but they're very quickly mobilized. And they literally fly in essentially a flying intensive care unit to Germany, and we treated them. Our average length of stay there was about 96 hours, and then they went to the United States. So it's a medical conveyor belt, and at each point they're getting amazing care.
And Carol, what was your role there? What did you end up doing?
When I first went over, and for my first three visits to Landstuhl, I worked with the chaplains through what was called at the time the Wounded Warrior Ministry Center, one-to-one with ill and wounded troops that had been transported from downrange, as they call it. Hearing their stories, when people get to in that kind of an environment, the time passes and you just find yourself wanting to be involved and to stay. What I learned there was that excellent care was being delivered in an atmosphere of constant change. Staff were changing as tours of duty changed. Patients were always changing. It was an atmosphere unlike anything I've seen in the civilian world. And I thought that perhaps one of the contributions I might offer, since I do some writing of my own in my nursing profession, was to share some of those insights with colleagues.
We do have these very segregated systems where there are military hospitals, there are VA hospitals, and then there are the kind of hospital where you work. What could these types of hospitals learn from each other? It seems like you've created a bit of a bridge there.
Well, a lot of the advances in trauma care that we're seeing now and actually using in the civilian practice have come out of war. It's probably the only good thing that comes out of war. And so how to deal with massive fluid resuscitation, how to deal with blood loss, and also how to transport critically ill patients. As you know, there's a doctor shortage in the United States, and not everyone is near a trauma center, so we're learning more and more how to transport these patients safely. You know, the monitoring has been miniaturized, all the equipment, so that you can get on a plane or a helicopter and travel those distances now safely if you have a stable patient.
And Carol, is there anything that you now bring to how you teach nursing, how you think about nursing, that you've learned during your many trips?
Absolutely. One of the outcomes of our relationship, beyond the trips that Mike and I have been privileged to do, are the ongoing meetings and teleconferences that I and about a dozen of my Villanova nursing colleagues have with Landstuhl, almost on a monthly basis. We connect with the nurse scientists and the Center for Nursing Science and Clinical Inquiry, as they call it over there. And there is a group of them and a group of us 6 hours apart and a continent away, sharing insights and consulting with each other about various aspects of nursing.
Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Carol and Michael Weingarten have taken several trips to volunteer at Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany. Carol is an associate professor of nursing at Villanova University. Michael is chief of vascular surgery at Drexel University College of Medicine. You're listening to The Pulse. Overcoming addiction is hard enough. Now imagine recovering from addiction while also managing obsessive-compulsive disorder and Tourette's syndrome. Sudie Madison is a dancer and choreographer in Philadelphia. Her company, called Band of Artists, creates multimedia productions that deal with her disorders. She has a new show that's running this weekend. It's called Order Out of Chaos, and it dissects alcoholism and obsessive-compulsive disorder through dance, spoken word, and original music. We caught up with Sudie Madison during a rehearsal, and all of the music you're going to hear is part of this performance.
I've always known that I've had some amount of obsessive-compulsive disorder. Because even when I was a child, 12 and 13 years old, I wanted to be a prima ballerina. And I was obsessed. I compared myself to every dancer. I would measure the width of my thighs every day. I would ask my sister to point the arch of her foot and compare mine to hers. Would I be able to make it? How perfect was my body? I was too short. I started to not eat. I became anorexic. But then as I began to drink and use other forms of alcohol into my teens and early 20s, I noticed that I started to mellow out. And I started to become that cool, calm teenager that, you know, who listens to rock and roll music and goes to parties and stuff. And, you know, that went on for years. And I guess I forgot about how crazy I was when I was 12 and 13. When I stopped drinking, finally, when I stopped drinking at 33 years old, the old Sudie came back. You know, the old me returned. And I'm like, whoa, she never went away. You know, that obsessive, compulsive, anxious, scared little girl, full of insecurities, who doesn't know how to manage her feelings, who doesn't know how to cope, isn't really sure how to live this life, is still there.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Right now, a Band of Artists is working on a new project called Order Out of Chaos, and it focuses on obsessive-compulsive disorder and alcoholism.
There has to be some balance between excitation, for example, worry.
During our show, one of our dance pieces, we have my neurologist doing a narration while the dancers are actually performing on stage in lieu of music.
But like OCD, like Tourette's syndrome, there's an imbalance between excitation and inhibition.
My neurologist, Dr. James Cook from the Abington Memorial Hospital, he's an excellent neurologist, and we've dealt with my obsessive compulsive disorder. We've dealt with my issues around depression because of OCD, because of Tourette's, because of my anxiety. And obsessive compulsive disorder, turns out, is, in fact, an anxiety disorder, leading up to my alcoholism, which was a way of me to self-medicate all this other stuff.
The person keeps thinking about it, thinking about it, thinking about it. The person keeps thinking about it, thinking about it.
I've kind of messed around with his vocals a little bit. So, for example, the words Order Out of Chaos that I've named the show, I've multiplied on it. So you hear it going, you know, Order Out of Chaos, Order Out of Chaos, Order Out of Chaos.
Order Out of Chaos, Order Out of Chaos. Order out of chaos.
So it has chaos, like a meter to it, chaos, so that it gives it order out of chaos, order out of chaos, order out, you know. And then the dancers have a meter because I've actually forced that with his words.
Order out of chaos, order out of chaos, order out of chaos.
Tell you what, man, when I got sober, I thought it was just about putting down alcohol. I thought it was just about stopping drinking. I had no idea it was about changing the way I thought, like changing my whole life. It was about deeper issues with me and how I felt about myself and self-confidence. I really want the audience to walk away from the show having learned how alcoholism and obsessive-compulsive disorder interact with each other and how they really do go hand in hand.
Sudie Madison is a dancer and choreographer in Philadelphia. Peter Crimmins produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, and Alana Gordon. Gray Tennis is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, the associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback, your questions, your ideas at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.